News Talks Off the Ball.
Home of the Saturday panel.
Thanks to Air. Catch Leinster versus Wasps exclusively live this weekend on the Air Sport Pack.
First chance to have a run at Al Abdaloui. Burns delivery. Collected by Ward. I don't think he was the intended target, but he's got a shot away! And he's done better than that. He's found the bottom corner. What a magnificent start for Northern Ireland. Respects, they're almost playing like the away team. As Davis threads it through, it's a lovely ball. Washington onside, this for 2-0. And he puts it away with great composure and quickly goes across, as he should, to celebrate the quality of the through ball from Stephen Davis, his captain.
All right, that was the sound of Northern Ireland's 2-0 win against Norway on Sunday. And I'm delighted to say we've got their manager, Michael O'Neill, on the line. Michael, how's life?
Very good, thanks. Very good. You know, had a great result, obviously, in the game on Sunday. So a big relief for us as well. And we can look forward to the second half of the campaign now.
In a weird way, those games where you're at home, because just that little bit more pressure against a team like Norway, where the fans obviously have this expectation because what you've achieved over the last couple of years, but actually they're the bloody hard games because Norway come thinking, well, we can turn these guys over.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, very dangerous game for us, really, because obviously the new coach in Lars Lagerbäck, who's not only very experienced, but very successful at international level, and they came, obviously, with, I think, knowing that, you know, they really needed to win the game to keep themselves in with a realistic chance of, you know, finishing in the top two. And so that made them a very dangerous opponent, and quite a difficult game for us to prepare for it, rather, just because, you know, you're looking at another coach's work in the previous games. And, you know, whilst we did as much preparation as we could, there was always an element of the unknown there. So we're very pleased with the performance and obviously pleased with the result. And it's, you know, I think Norway under Lars Lagerbäck will improve, and hopefully, you know, they take points off, you know, perhaps the Czech Republic and Azerbaijan going forward.
Michael, just touching on something that Jez mentioned there about teams coming to Windsor Park. Over the years, it's always been, if you get your home results right, then you'll have a better chance of qualification. And when this sort of game comes up, it hasn't necessarily gone to plan, as Jez said. So how have you changed the mentality that you've got your home form as good as it actually has been?
I think there's many factors, really. You know, we worked very hard, you know, on the preparation of the team in terms of how we would play. And you know, we don't particularly open ourselves up, you know, home or away unnecessarily. And I think in the past, you know, we maybe played well for periods and games, and then we would be picked off by quality opposition and put ourselves in a difficult position then to try and get back into the game. And you know, now with the new stadium and the atmosphere in the stadium, it's quite difficult at times because the players obviously play off emotion and the fans want you to attack all the time. But I think we've got a really set way of playing. You know, like, for example, you know, in the last two home games, Azerbaijan and Norway, for example, have had more possession than we've had. But, you know, we've ultimately scored six and they haven't scored any. So I think it's just getting the belief in the players. And that came from possibly just winning away from home to begin with. You know, we had a period where we played away from home. You know, at one point we played eight internationals in a row away from home, and, you know, people were picking on our results. But equally, we were in a situation where it was very difficult to play at home just because the stadium wasn't particularly in great shape for international football. So I think it's a combination of factors. But the biggest thing I think now as well is that the players really enjoy playing at home. They don't feel, yes, there's expectation and you know, that comes with, you know, the added pressure, but I think they're genuinely enjoying it. I think there's a new pitch in the stadium that they genuinely enjoy as well. And, you know, as you might say, between now, we've picked up 9 points at home out of a possible nine, scored 10 goals, not conceded. You know, our really two tough games with the Czech Republic and Germany at home, but we'll approach those games with, you know, a lot to gain and obviously a lot of confidence.
And there's no shortage of quality as well. I just watching the game from the weekend, Michael, the second goal that you scored, when it started out with Conor McLaughlin in right back, it gets played into midfield. Brilliant through ball through to Conor Washington, the way that he'd finished it. That's got to give you great pride with how the team are actually playing. It's not necessarily just going out and grinding results. It's the level of performance that the team's putting in as well.
No, it has been the level of performance and some of the goals that we've scored. You know, we've gained a reputation for being very strong at set pieces, and we do work on that. But equally, you know, we've scored some great goals as well. And we don't have the biggest players really in the middle of the pitch, you know, like the likes of Davis, Norwood, Jamie Ward, you know, Dallas, they're, you know, they cover the ground well, so they have to play at a tempo. What we do emphasise to the players is that we don't want meaningless possession. You know, we don't want six, seven passes to get into the final third if we can get there in two or three. And, you know, once we're in the final third, we want end product. So, you know, that's probably why maybe our possession stats aren't as high, because we do encourage the players to play forward as quickly as possible. And it's slightly different, I think, sometimes from maybe, you know, certainly Johnny Evans, when he was at Manchester United, was used to playing in a very possession-based team. And I think at times he found it, not difficult, but it was just, you know, a bit of a contrast from what he was asked to do at club. Davis is the same, but I think, you know, they see the benefit of, you know, getting the ball forward quickly through the thirds of the pitch, and also because the attacking players that we have all benefit from the ball, receiving the ball early. They're, we don't really have like a number 10, so to speak, that's going to unlock a, you know, a team that maybe gets men behind the ball, and you know, we're at our best obviously pretty much in the counter-attack, and we have to then obviously to maximise that, we have to play quickly, and thankfully, as I say, the players have taken that on board and they've done it exceptionally well.
There's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about the Euros and just the immediate aftermath of a tournament like that, where the fans go and have this absolutely sensational experience. It's very easy for a team to kind of be a bit after the Lord Mayor's show, where you kind of come back in the next qualifying campaign, you know, you're looking up that whole mountain again going, geez, we've got to climb that. But that wasn't really an issue for you at all. You managed to use that as the momentum for this campaign. Was that straightforward? Was that easy enough for you to do?
It wasn't straightforward, and it was a fear. We didn't go into the first game away in Prague in the best of shape, to be honest, in terms of, you know, we played four players in that game who had played very little first-team football since the start of the season. And our squad, in terms of being game-ready, I don't think wasn't as strong as what it had been. But what we did have was we had the benefit of being together for that period of time at the Euros in preparation, and we've never had that before. You know, you get sporadic, you know, bursts of 9 and 10 days over a qualification campaign. But basically at the Euros, I think, between preparation and tournament, we were together for, I think, the best part of maybe 40 days. So how the group, you know, developed, you know, personally, but also in terms of, like, the work that we were able to do for all of those games, and the players believing that they could obviously handle that level of opposition and in those types of atmospheres was hugely beneficial. And what we actually did was, for the Czech Republic game, we took them back to the base in Austria where we'd been before France, and it was almost like a little bit of a reminder, just to let you know, this is where we did all our good work, and they took it on board. And, you know, against the Czech Republic, we didn't play particularly well, but we managed to get out of there 0-0. And, you know, as I say, it was a very valuable point to us. And we followed it up, obviously, with the, you know, the three home wins. And, you know, we were beaten in Germany, but I think, you know, given the quality of the opposition, we did give a good account of ourselves.
When you saw what Wales did in the Euros after they beat you guys with an own goal, 15 minutes left to go in a game that most people feel, you know, it could definitely have gone either way. Is there, so ultimately, do you guys look back a little bit with disappointment and think what might have been, or do you need to make accommodation for the fact that, you know, Northern Ireland got out of their group at a major tournament and were one of the stories of that tournament?
I tend to be the former, to be honest. I look on it with disappointment because, you know, probably in that game, we really stifled Aaron Ramsey and Gareth Bale in the game. And, you know, it was only the one time that they combined in the game that, you know, led to the cross, which, you know, caused the own goal. And I felt we were in relatively comfortable and not, I wouldn't say in control of the game, but I didn't feel we were, you know, in a position where we looked like we were going to lose the game. Our biggest problem probably in the Euros was our players, you know, our attacking players having an impact on the game. And, you know, we did go into the tournament with no one really in great goal scoring form in the sense, like, Will Gregg was our, you know, who had scored goals in League One, but, you know, Lafferty and Washington hadn't played very much in the second half of the season, nor had Jamie Ward at their respective clubs. So that was always our challenge, was like, how, you know, how you can turn a 0-0 into a 1-0 win. And you know, that's always going to be our fact, you know, our biggest challenge and one of the biggest factors in how we'll do as a team. And, you know, that was, but I did have a sense of disappointment because I felt that had we got beyond Wales, you know, I did feel we certainly had another game in us, and it would have suited us to go and play a Belgium, despite the fact that we would have had to play in a very, controlled fashion and obviously give away a lot of possession. But, you know, I think when you get to that stage of the tournament, you are dreaming. And it was a bit harsh on us, I felt, probably, to lose the game against Wales, the nature that we did.
What, Michael, what did you say then at the start of this campaign when you probably were reflecting on what had happened at the Euros? What did you say to the team and how... Because we have seen it constantly, where you've had such a big high after a major tournament that you can have that big low afterwards. It's almost as if everything that's gone before you and what you've done just previously goes out the window. So how have you managed to keep the team remain focused?
I think, you know, we do quite a bit with the team in terms of, you know, motivational stuff, you know, and, you know, we always, you know, play them sort of videos linked to, you know, different games, and we do a lot in terms of the analysis of the opposition, analysis of our own play as well. Not like forensically, but just we try to keep the buoyancy in the group, you know, and thankfully, as I say, we've got a lot of grounded lads within the group that make that quite straightforward. You know, certainly in terms of our players, they didn't get carried away from the experience they had in France. You know, they enjoyed the tournament. They wanted to take as much from it as possible. But, you know, coming into this, you know, we outlined, listen, this is going to be every bit as difficult, if not more difficult, to qualify. But we believe that, you know, look at the group, look at the fixtures. This is how we believe, you know, if we can get off to the right start, we need to have, I had said to the players, we need to have a minimum of 6 points after the first four games. I said if we have seven or we have nine or more, we're going to be in great shape. And then you come into it again, and I just said to them again that once we get to 10 points, you start to then look at the combinations and you start to look at fixtures without necessarily getting ahead of yourself.
Yeah.
But, you know, that we play Azerbaijan and then we play San Marino, for example, where Czech Republic play Norway away and play Germany at home. So whilst we have difficult games at the tail end of the group, we possibly could have a cushion if we can maintain our form and possibly Czech Republic, you know, have two very difficult games in Game 6 and Game 7. And sometimes the fixtures work for you, sometimes they work against you, but at this minute in time, they're sort of slightly favourable to us at this minute.
Michael, just in relation to those motivational videos that you showed, is it all just positive stuff on what they've actually done on the pitch? Do you kind of use anything else to try to get into the players' minds?
It's all stuff that happens on the pitch.
Yeah.
It's the supporters. It's the reaction of the supporters in terms of, you know, filming the crowd. It's the training, you know, just seeing the interaction with the players, how they interact with each other on the training pitch. You can see how they celebrate goals together, even things where possibly they're coming off the bus together, you know, and they're laughing and joking. And you're just showing at times maybe a little bit more of the personal element of it. That, you know, it's not just 20 goals one after the other. It's all done and it's kind of choreographed in a way which shows a really strong team spirit. And it shows, I think, you know, again, you know yourself when you're away with a group of players that, you know, to keep that mood's very, very important.
Yeah.
And it just shows the togetherness in them all and that they, you know, we really enjoyed France. You know, they enjoyed being together. And that was something that I took a lot of heart from that, because that was my one concern, you know, going into the tournament was, you know, we've been together for 10, 11 days, but we're going to be together for 40 days. It was going to test a lot of us. And, you know, as I say, thankfully, the experience was a positive one for everyone. And that comes from, you know, that team spirit and that togetherness comes from the players. And it's vital, you know, at the end of the day, in many ways, I think, you know, the human aspect for it is every bit as important, if not more important, than the tactical aspect.
Just on the tactical aspect, you said you like to get the ball forward to your players pretty quickly. There's been a fairly robust conversation going on about the Republic style and just this general consensus that players who play in England largely don't have the technical close skills to manage a game from midfield the way other countries seem to be able to do. And I don't really know where I come down on that side of the argument, but I'm interested in you as a former midfield player who now manages an international team. What's your take on that?
I think a lot's made of it, you know, in terms of... I don't think that the Republic of Ireland or ourselves will ever have great success trying to be a 60-65% based possession team. in all honesty. You know, I don't think Wales would have that either. You know, Wales are at their best because, you know, they have two players who are ultimately two match winners in Ramsey and Bale. I think that, you know, you have to be careful as well in the fact that the players, like how many players in, you know, for example, the Republic team, playing teams that have loads of possession on a weekly basis. You know, most of the players are playing in the bottom half of the Premier League. So they're not, you know, they're not players that are playing, you know, for Manchester City or Chelsea or Manchester United. Like our players, the same scenario that we face. So I think that you just have to be realistic. You have to find a way to win. And to be fair, Martin's done that. I think the Republic results in this campaign have been fantastic, given, you know, they've played three games away from home. They've shown that they're able to win away from home. And ultimately, you know, if you kept the ball for 65, 70% of the game and lost 1-0, the people that can play in still wouldn't be happy. So I wouldn't dwell on it too much, to be honest. You know, I think at this minute in time, you know, to have 11 points after the five games as Ireland do and remain unbeaten, I would look on the positive side of it. And I think, you know, that's a very important thing. I think we have a lot of, you know, you need the media positive, because if the media are positive, the crowd will be positive, and because they'll believe what they read in the media, and then you have a better atmosphere around the whole thing. And certainly, you know, as I say, I've noticed that in us, you know, in terms of the media around our team is extremely positive, where, you know, it was difficult over the years for them to write positively about a team that wasn't winning. But as I say, that's changed. And I think, you know, the Ireland fans and the Ireland media should look at the fact that, you know, you're in a great position to qualify for Russia and have maintained the form all the time that you haven't found as well.
Michael, I've seen you speaking recently about maybe the play you've spoken there about the players, but about the perhaps the lack of young talent that Northern Ireland are able to get through, and maybe the levels that some of those younger players are playing at in the lower regions of England, perhaps over there in Northern Ireland yourself as well. So, how difficult a job is that for you to try to put together structure in? You maybe a long-term plan that's in place up there in Northern Ireland. How difficult of a job is that for you then to try to find these players now?
You know, we haven't had that many changes to our squad, but it is a concern down the road that, you know, I look at, you know, where our younger players are. For example, our under-21 team may only have one or possibly two players who are actually first-team players at League 2 level. So, you know, it's changed days from possibly when your under-21s were ready-made to come in and be part of your senior team. That's not necessarily the case, unfortunately. You know, our better players tend to bypass 21, like the likes of a Paddy McNair, who just came straight into the senior squad, basically, from under-19 because he was ready. And it's something that we're working very hard at. We're doing a lot of work at underage level, you know, obviously from the ages of 11 to 16 when the boys are, in, you know, based at home. But ultimately, when they go across to England, you know, their development really comes out of our hands at that time. And unfortunately, we're seeing still too many players come home and not having the impact that we would like at their clubs. So it's a constant challenge, Kevin, but something we just have to continue to work at. And hopefully, as I say, bit by bit, we'll get, you know, one or two players through every year. And then hopefully that'll be enough to, you know, maintain the progress that we've made.
Is that why you were particularly annoyed with the FAI recently about the Mac and Ifs, and just that general sense that at underage level, you know, it felt like what you were saying was, you know, maybe at senior level when they get to be adults and they're ready to make their mind up, then they should be allowed to make their mind up. But in the meantime, if we're developing players, you know, you should play fair here?
Well, the point I was trying to make, to be honest, and it wasn't maybe reported in this way in the media, was that it wasn't really an FAI thing. It was about that young players really changing their international allegiance or eligibility between the ages of 17 to 21. I don't think it's particularly a fair of another association to ask a player to do that, because you don't know where your career is at that minute in time. You know, and UEFA, FIFA only allow you to make that change once in your whole career. So for a 17-year-old boy to be asked, after he's represented Northern Ireland, to change to play for the Republic of Ireland, for example, at under-19, and then to see possibly his career not flourish, he can't come back and play for Northern Ireland. So I don't think the player's ready to make that decision. I think the players make the decision on an emotional basis, possibly because of where they're brought up, the friends that they have around them, all of those factors come into the equation. We totally understand that. But I just think that a young player, once he's represented a country, whether it's Northern Ireland or whoever, that you should be allowed to play for that country and be left alone to play for that country until they're past the age of 21.
Does it put more pressure on you then, Michael, to try and cap these lads at a younger age?
No, not really.
No.
I wouldn't do that, to be honest. I wouldn't put a pitch if he didn't want to go on. You know, we've said that. We have said that openly to the players. I remember, you know, at one time when Ryan McLaughlin was, you know, I think a little bit undecided where his international future was, and Ryan was in the senior squad, and I said to him, if he didn't want to go on the pitch, I understood that, but he said no. He was firm in his mind that he wanted to play for Northern Ireland. I wouldn't deprive a player in that situation, to be honest. He has to know in his mind that he's ready to go on. And you know, I certainly wouldn't take like an 18-year-old and throw him into a game just to prevent someone else having him, because ultimately I think you have a bit more responsibility as a manager to do that. You know, I have to look at the player and I have to see genuinely, you know, where is he, you know, is he going to be good enough? Will he develop as a player? And you never know, which is why, you know, as I say, when we see some of the younger players who have made that decision, you know, I genuinely don't think it's been the best thing for their career from a football point of view. Equally, if they're 100% in their mind that they feel that they want to play for the Republic of Ireland or whoever it may be, or England, you know, we're not in a position to stop them. You know, we don't try to stop them. We just try to point out to them that, you know, they're well really restricting what their options are further down the line.
Michael, that's great. Thank you very much for everything. Cheers.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Thank you.
Off the ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should there be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
All right, you're very welcome along to the football show this evening. If you missed it a little bit earlier on, we had Michael O'Neill, the Northern Ireland manager, on. Pretty interesting about a load of stuff. We didn't talk about the tactically he likes to get the ball forward pretty quickly because he doesn't have a number 10.
Yeah,
it's like, these are my resources, this is how we're going to use them. And getting Stephen Davis and Johnny Evans on side early on, that kind of means that's, if those guys are in the changing room and on the pitch and they believe in it, then that's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned there earlier on as well, but the quality of the goals that they're actually scoring, the one of the night from Jamie Ward and certainly the one from Connor Washington, how they moved it through midfield, but quick, incisive passing forward, but not necessarily direct, not going back to front or anything like that, but direct passing, where they're passing it, trying to break lines, trying to break opposition's lines, players picking up positions, getting themselves free, quick turns, quick forward passing, and it's effective, but it's actually good to watch. They play good counter-attacking football, and something that he said there, he knows that they're playing to the team strength. They've not got players that are playing in the top teams over in England, that a majority of the time they're having 60, 70% possession of the ball. It's they're the side, or the players, should I say, that's playing in teams that are having 30, 40% possession. So he's devised a plan, or tried to devise a plan, that's utilising the players' skills, playing within that structure where they're going to have a lot less ball in the opposition. But it's how they break quickly, and it's, he's doing a great job. Brilliant job.
This is being compared and contrasted with how Ireland are doing. I think they've played 3 home games and they've conceded none and scored 10 goals, and we've played 3 home games and scored no goals, and things aren't going great for us.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. I suppose you mean we're looking at the friendly of the night. I suppose the ones that do matter. Well, we scored one, didn't we? We scored the Georgia goal.
Yeah.
But the game against Wales, we've not conceded. So the games that matter, we're not conceding. So there's probably an argument for both, isn't there? Michael O'Neill there, he was saying, look, how can anybody complain about Martin O'Neill's results? The results that they get in the top of the group, how can anybody complain about it? But it's just at home, the lack of chances that is actually being created, and that it probably is a worry. I think without Wes Hoolan, I think that was, as we said earlier on, it's highlighted that fact that we don't really create an awful lot when he's not in the side.
If we'd had Harry Arter and Robbie Brady in the team, but not Wes?
Potentially. I mean, if he puts Brady a little bit further forward, because that's, I think he played left back last night, and I think we probably lack something further forward because of that. He was the one that was maybe trying to dictate play from left back, and that's a difficulty in itself, that he's actually almost becoming a playmaker from left back. So if he plays a bit further forward, yes, I think he will create more chances. And Harry Arter, the one thing I was looking at Conor Horan last night, I wanted to see him be that player that's going to go and try and get on the end of things, go and get on the end of crosses, because we've not had a midfielder like that for a while now, that's someone that's really prepared to go and get himself goals.
And since Andy Townsend?
Possibly. Mark Kinsler was probably a little bit like that, where we used to get on the end and try to get on the end of chances. But yeah, I'd probably say that a player of that type that can go and score goals as well, and he's certainly got the ability to do that, but he just perhaps just didn't quite happen for him last night.
Does a player like that need a bit more build-up play to predict and time his runs about when he's going to get into the box, as opposed to what we did for a lot of that first half?
It's a great point. It is. And he probably needs someone alongside him that's prepared to go and get the ball. And I think last night, Jeff Hendrick wasn't that player that was prepared to go and get the ball and change the direction of play. And it's something that we spoke about after the Wales game. Both Glenn Whelan, David Myler and Jeff Hendrick, when they were receiving the ball, the first touch was always back where the ball came from, or back towards their own goal, not necessarily turning out. And it was exactly the same last night. Similar sort of performance from, even though we went with a different system last night, I suppose, but with the two lads in midfield with a real reluctance to take the ball and change play.
Eunan O'Kane, every time, took it on the back foot, turned out.
Yeah.
Interestingly, we had Jeff Hendrick on the show last week, and you remember just before Euro 2016, they played a game in Turner's Cross in the sunshine, and
Moldova.
Then they picked the squad.
Belarus, sorry.
Yeah.
Hendrick was saying to us last week that he stunk the joint out in that game. And he didn't name who exactly, but he said people close to him said, Jeff, you can't play like this. You actually can't play like this when you go to the Euros. And he really booked himself up. I mean, myself and Kev were just talking earlier in the office. I mean, he could do it having a chat with that person again. And
time for
booking
those
people
to,
well, there was a sense last night when you were watching Jeff Hendrick, and a little bit against Wales as well, difficult game, but like, what are you waiting for here?
He did look a bit nervous. He is playing within himself because of the ability that he's got. He's certainly a player that can take it and should be, perhaps, as maybe John O'Shea alluded to as well, perhaps trying to dictate play a little bit more. Yeah,
I thought he was better in the second half against Wales than he was in the first half. He was actually coming a bit deeper. He was very isolated in that first half, but in the second half actually got on a bit more. Now look, it was really bad in the first half, was a tiny bit better in the second half, so maybe kind of splitting hairs on that. But
I take your point on it. I just think with what he's got, he's certainly a player. But perhaps he and Conor Horan are similar type players. You might need somebody a little bit different. And again, it goes back to the point, is maybe when we've not got an Arter who's prepared to do that, Arter will take the ball. It's not necessarily his first touch back towards play. And all these sort of things, it points to the fact is, and how poor we've probably looked without Wes Hoolan in the side. That's the overriding factor of this, I think.
Let me bring you some of the post-match audio here, and we've also got some Daryl Horgan stuff speaking with Oisin. But first, Martin O'Neill, here he is talking about the new lads and a bit of the pressure they were under.
Well, first of all, you know, regardless of debuts, regardless of changes in the side, you still want to win the game. You know, and naturally disappointed with that. And of course, with the number of substitutions that we made, you can change a bit of momentum, a bit of impetus. But overall, in the second half, I thought when we had a lot of possession and some very, very decent balls go across the penalty area and no one to touch them into the net, and that was disappointing. But overall, some of the lads did exceptionally well.
A little earlier, James McLean spoke about the flatness of the performance. He said there was a bit of a kick up the backside. He said the flatness, particularly in the first half. What do you put that failure almost of us to impose ourselves in that game in the first half down to?
No, I think you could nearly say the same about both teams. Of course, remember, first of all, we're coming off the back of Friday evening. So you're going into this game in a different mindset, different mode. You still want to win the match, obviously. Some players feel as if, you know, this is their time to play. And almost as if they're being judged on a 45-minute performance. And so there's a wee bit of extra pressure there, and so players maybe just need to relax a wee bit. But the ball was like a hot potato in the first half. I thought in the second half we were in more than reasonable control, and we dominated for long periods in the game. That said, you still have to create chances, which I think that we did in terms of that, and we also need to put the ball in the net, which we didn't do.
You normally don't like to single players out, but who was it that stood out for you from that group tonight?
Well, I think, naturally, I think I'd rather keep that in the dressing room, like anything else, but, you know, I think some of the lads who played for the very first time can be very proud of themselves.
Very poor questions there, weren't they?
Yeah, shocking.
But I don't know what you can...
Like, really?
Yeah, it's the point that we've already spoke about earlier as well, I would say that a certain amount of nervousness did come into it again last night. I only need to think about my own debut and exactly how nervous I was around that. So there is that, yeah.
But, okay, just for the benefit of... I know people missed maybe our chat at 7 o'clock or this podcast listeners. Like, the ultimate point we were making there was this was very, very poor and you can't escape that fact. It was really, really poor.
Well,
there was
no... I don't agree with any of that, right? So that's the point you're making, right? My theory is that this matters not a jot to the management team or to any of the players who aren't making their debuts, and that actually what happened to Seamus Coleman hangs like a horrible smell over everything from the moment that happens to... Because that's all I read about. That's all that's been on Sky Sports News. I think it poisoned anybody's desire or willingness to play and just the any sense of momentum that they had about playing for Ireland. That's my theory.
Hmm. I think the players are always going to, you know, take a game like that seriously, and especially guys who haven't many caps. It's a big night for them. They will feel desperately sorry for Seamus Coleman. By the time Sunday evening, Monday, and certainly Tuesday comes around, I think a lot of them are ready to go and want to do very well. And it's a huge night for them.
There's probably
a bit of truth in both.
Yeah,
for
I
sure
think there is.
I don't doubt the Coleman thing affected part of the preparation. But like the points we were sort of making earlier on, what were we trying to do as a team? Were we trying to pass the ball around? Not really, not in that evidence. Were we trying to go long and do a clever? Not really, not in that evidence. If you were to ask a lot of the players out there, Kev, like what's the plan? I'm not so sure a lot of them would have had a great answer for you. Yeah, I think they would have known.
I think there's an element of they're playing at that level for a reason. They've earned the right to play at that level. Sometimes there's got to be a lot of finding it out for yourself in many respects, not necessarily you know, having to rely solely upon what the manager says to you. But yeah, your point is certainly valid that you do have to have a structure to the side, and the players have got to play within that structure, and they've got to then try and play, get the best out of themselves for the team and for their own good as well by playing within that structure.
What was the formation? What were we like?
We played a 4-4-2 last night. Changed the system from the other night where we were more of a 4-3-3 come 4-5-1 essentially. But we went to a orthodox 4-4-2, yeah.
Kevin Doyle and
James McLean up front.
Okay.
McLean got very frustrated and just started roaming everywhere. And he probably had the freedom to do that. So McGeady on one wing, Hayes on the other wing, Horahan and Hendrick in the middle. Ideally getting on the ball, or if not doing that, which didn't happen, then pushing further up the field. Like Pearce and Egan were left by the Icelandic forwards to their own devices, really, when they were on the ball. They weren't pressed or harried very much. I think because the Icelandic forwards recognised that maybe they're not brilliant ball players. I don't know enough about Egan, but certainly Pearce, they didn't feel was going to hurt them overly. And neither of those ever stepped into midfield with the ball to try and get us playing. Robbie Brady did once or twice, and it worked. When he had no option, he just beat a man and walked into midfield and slipped it off, and suddenly we were away. Like, I'll defer to Keith Andrews, obviously. Keith, I mentioned this earlier in the show, but for people who didn't catch it, Keith was just talking about, in a general way, he didn't feel like there was a plan. He didn't feel like there was a pattern to our play. So when we got the ball, he didn't feel like anyone was really on the same page. And he wasn't saying this was... He didn't mean in nuanced, complicated terms. He meant in very basic terms. And one of the examples he gave us on air last night, which I thought was a really good one, was, for instance, when a midfielder got turned on the ball, a very simple pattern of play you would repeatedly see is, say, the winger, like McGeady, will come in off the wing, and if the fullback doesn't go with him, then McGeady gets the ball in front of their back four and he's suddenly very, very dangerous. If the fullback does go with him, then Kevin Doyle can crisscross and spin into all that space, and the centre half gets dragged down an alleyway with him and a ball's crossed in, and there's a chance, there's a sniff of a chance. So Andrew said, we had none of that. Like, none of that. And no cohesion to what we're trying to do. And he said, fair enough, if we want to be a long ball team, fair enough, but then let's
do we
have Hendrick.
Not have any of the players, like
I don't know. If we don't, I was just going to finish on this point. If we want to be a lot, if we don't feel without Wes, we can have 20-30 passes in midfield. I think that's fair enough. I think we have to be realistic. But then if we're going to go a bit longer to Doyle or a bit more direct, which can still be brilliant football if you have the 20-30 yard pass, then the likes of Horan and Hendrick should be aware of this, and they're kind of moving to support him instead of the ball going over their heads.
Can I posit a possibility of us ever seeing Kevin Doyle and the midfielders behind him in that constellation is, we're never going to see that team ever play for
no,
Ireland.
No, but you may see,
yeah,
you may
individuals,
see, you,
yeah.
You may see Hendrick and McLean and potentially McGeady on the pitch at the same time again, and they need to form some sort of relationship.
Brady as well, yeah.
And Brady.
Yeah, but I think they'll be able to do that because they're going to be a bit more into the game, because it'll mean something a bit more than a friendly on a Tuesday night against Iceland.
Honestly, they're 1-0 down, they're shouting at each other. They're looking like McLean is livid. Brady is livid. He's a captain for the first time. It's a long unbeaten run at home. He does not want to lose that record. Egan, it's the biggest game in his life. Alex Pearce, it's a huge game. Christie, it's a huge game.
Yeah.
There was honest effort. It was, they were into it. They were really trying, and they could sense the crowd weren't happy.
Okay, we've got Richard Dunn on the line. Richard, good evening to you.
How are you doing? All right.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
What did you think of the game?
Yeah, just listening there to you. I think it was, you're right in what you're saying, it was a poor performance. There was nothing to it at all, you know. There was nothing that gave you any sort of belief that we were going to get something out of the game, because it was just long balls into the channel, but nobody backing it up, nobody supporting it, and it was just a bit of hit and hope. And even in terms of setting up for long throws and people not being in the right areas, whether we were setting up for long throws, whether we were just playing them off the cuff or what they were doing, there was nothing that we thought, well, the way we're going here, we look like we're going to break them down, we're going to do this, that's going to keep walking, and we keep going down that wing or through the middle or whatever. It was just, like you say, it was just a bit of a nothing performance. So I would imagine the manager hasn't really got out and over, because tactically there was nothing there. And I think for the players as well, it was a difficult game for them, because they didn't have any shape that they had to sort of stick to.
You obviously worked with Martin O'Neill for a long period of time. Like, was that because he didn't tell them what to do last night? Is that because he expects them to know themselves? Is that because they're not working on shape?
I honestly don't know. You know, when I worked with Martin, it was, he had coaches, he'd done that sort of thing, and Martin would come in and he would obviously set out the training in terms of what he wants from a team, but he would have his coaches doing it. So I don't know with the Irish setup who's doing the tactics and stuff like that, but you could see last night it didn't seem like they had a game plan going into the match. The difference in the two sides was massive. I think I wouldn't say man for man Iceland had a better team, but certainly they were better on the night because of the tactics they had. They had two hard working centre forwards, they had good midfielders on the ball, they were comfortable on the ball, wanting to pass it forward and wanting to follow their passes, and they knew what they wanted to do. And when you brought subs on, they all knew the plan and they all stuck to it, and they looked comfortable all night, whereas we were just going left, right, centre, see where we could break anyone down, but without ever threatening anyone.
I should say as well, I know you want to come in, Kev, that was a second string Icelandic team, so the notion that we played our second string so they wouldn't know the plan as well as the first starting 11,
yeah.
I mean, compare that to the Iceland backup team who had a plan, as Richard says.
Yeah, Rich, I wanted to ask you, Rich, about do you think that Friday night's the Seamus Coleman incident, do you think that did play a part in last night? Because it's something we spoke about here, it has been mentioned. So do you think though that would have affected the players coming into the game last night?
I think it can do, Kev. I think, they've spent a long time building themselves up for that Wales game, together as well for a week or whatever, leading up to that game, and it's a lot of pressure going into that match, and you can sense it and imagine around the hotel, and everyone's so focused on that game that when it's actually over and it's out of the way, there's a little bit of a drop, I suppose, in intensity, and whether it be in training or just a little bit of pressure has come off, and it's hard to pick it up again after a couple of days, you know, to go again. And I know it's a big game for a lot of the lads making debuts and trying to make their way into a team, but as well with it, like you say, with that Seamus thing, that's just an added little downer on the after the big qualifier, and then what happened with Seamus, it just all comes down, and it's difficult to pick it up again. And I think you could see that in the performance last night. And as much as, like, you would never ever even doubt that the lads didn't try, they gave everything last night, but sometimes you're just missing that little spark in your performance, and I think that's what was missing last night.
I definitely don't doubt they tried. Like, you could see the body language was good. They all wanted to do really well. It's a huge night for a lot of them. I think it was just the absence of a plan, Richard. it was really hard to know what they were trying to do at any point. It looked like a team that had been named late on. they were told, right, go out, you know what to do, get about it. And very quickly it would have become apparent to them, well, we're not actually sure what we're doing here. And, you know, I would have looked at, say, the two centre-halves. You can relate to that position. Egan and Pearce, they didn't seem entirely sure. Should they be forcing it into midfield to players, or should they be going long in certain ways, and or should they be, you know, walking the ball? They weren't pressed a lot of the time. So should they be walking the ball into midfield and giving it to a spare man? It didn't seem like they even knew some basics like that.
No, it didn't. That's the way it was last night. And for the team, it would have been so much easier if the managers just said, right, when Westwood has the ball, everyone push up, kick it long, see if Doyle can run a flick on and get lads running in behind. Whereas what actually happened, the whole team was spread out miles.
Yeah.
And we'd go along, and there was no, Kevin Doyle was just running and running and running, just getting no support, no help. And it was a thankless task for him last night. But you look back and in hindsight, it's easy, but it's such an easy plan to set out. And it's just, right, go long or pass it or do something, but don't just send them out onto the pitch with nothing, really, you know. And I think even with James McLean, he was playing in a position which didn't help him and didn't help the team, because sometimes the best way of getting the ball is just to stand still. But he was just constantly on the move and maybe coming into people's spaces where Kevin could come into, or Danny Hayes was trying to come into places where McLean was, and it just all seemed so uncoordinated and, like I say, just off the cuff, and nobody was helping each other, and everyone was trying to help each other, but it just wasn't working for anyone.
Because there's no way you can almost stop the game and get everyone into a huddle and say, right, we're all on different pages here, no one knows what we're doing, let's just go long. Like, they didn't seem to have that experience or that ability to sort it out once the game had started.
No, I don't think so. The way Iceland played, it was perfect for them. You had really big guys at the back, and they were just, right, am I trying to go long? And they were one of the headers. But when they got the ball, they knew, they passed it on the ground, and they had a centre forward that could hold it up, lay it off. But he always had support. So it's so much easier for them. They were moving as a team, so they were always within 40 yards from front to back, where they were spread out the whole pitch. So it is difficult. But the manager's there on the sideline. It's quite simple for him just to tell everyone to push up, or everyone to sit back for 5 minutes or whatever. But like we say, it was just it didn't seem like there was any leadership, like you say, whether it be on the pitch or on the sideline last night. It just seemed to be a little bit of a get this game out of the way, give some people a cap, and then we'll move on to the next one.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. I think we're massively overreacting to a friendly.
But we're just analysing the performance, though, Ger.
Yeah, but the whole point of that is that it's largely irrelevant. Like the game that matters is the game against Wales. This performance is a performance from, like, if you look at the starting 11, the only player who's actually playing in his actual position is Jeff Hendrick. None of the rest of those players, maybe Cyrus Christie will potentially start at right back. But nobody else is starting in positions where they're going to start for Ireland again.
So the logic being, don't get together for an hour and have some kind of plan. Like,
are you saying that they didn't have any plan?
Yeah, they didn't. They didn't. Rich, that's what Richard Dunn's assessment is there.
No, but Richard started here at the same
time. Martin O'Neill didn't tell them anything to do last night, and that they had no plans. And even during the game, they didn't go push up.
Well, they would have. That comes down to your own knowledge as well. They would have been able to have that chat amongst themselves. They've got enough experience there with Steve Walker, Steve Guppy, Roy Keane. They've got enough experience where they're going to get this sort of guidance along the way. Of course they are. But as I say, Richard started off there by saying he's not too sure what Martin Hill could take from it. But Rich, there was a lot of debutants last night. There's a lot of players that have tried to make the mark last night. What could Martin O'Neill's assessment have been of the new lads that's coming into the squad that's trying to make this impression on him then?
Like I say, Kev, it's really difficult for anyone last night, because everyone was sort of playing an individual performance. There's no one that you can say, well, he worked well in the team, or he was fitting here or fitting there. I think John Hayes started off really lively and looked good on the ball at times. And even, I think Egan, I said, half years, he got that bang in the first minute, and then maybe held position for the free kick for the goal. But for him, it's the recovery afterwards, you know. You could easily drop your head and just sort of let the game pass you by, but he's done really well after that period, and I thought he looked comfortable at international level. And then the second half, obviously, when Hogan came on, that's when we started to look like we had something. You know, we wanted to get the ball to him and he wanted to get down the line and cross balls, and the only problem we had then was we didn't have, I suppose, a release from midfield and people wanting to get in the box and break the net to try and get in there and score goals. But that's something as well that will, that we hopefully will improve on as we go forward.
Yeah, what about that lack of creativity then, Rich? Because, you know, okay, fair enough, the big positive we can take out, we've not conceded. It was fairly comfortable against Wales from a defensive point of view. But three games now, we've spoken about it, last three home games were very, very few chances created in all three of those matches across the three games. So do you see that as a problem going forward, or do you see that we're quite happy that we're not actually conceding the goals?
Yeah, I think the manager will be happy on that side of it. That we're always in a position where we can nick something. You know, I don't think it will ever be completely gung-ho and just try and run all over teams. I think we'll always be a team that will keep ourselves in games and hopefully get that little spark maybe from James McLean or from Shane Long or from Hendrick O'Brady. The setup of the team will always be, listen, just stay in this match. The points that we've already got on the board will hold us in great stead, and if we can stay in games, pick up a point, and hopefully miss games, I think that's going to be more or less the plan going forward for the next four or five qualifiers.
That's not really a plan, though, is it? Like, that's the point you're making here.
Well, that's the plan that he's had before. The only difference, when he walked out Aston Villa, he had probably quicker players where the transition from defence to attack was more of a counter, so we became a counter-attacking team because we had faster players, we had more probably technical players and people who could, as a team, we would move from back to forward a lot quicker than what the Irish team did, certainly did last night. But I think that's sort of something that he set up at Aston Villa, where we played a 4-5-1 formation with both wingers trying to get up as quick as they can to the centre forward, and the turnover from back to front would be quick. But it was always a case of when we were under the cosh, everyone would be back behind the ball defending.
Why don't we talk about the Wales game, because we didn't do much of it in that game either.
No, well, we never broke forward at all, and but that was all down to retaining the possession of the ball. We didn't seem to be able to hold on to the ball at all. We just all got behind the ball, defended to where we wanted to, cleared it, and then just sat back in. We never pressed them up high enough to cause them any trouble.
Yeah, Rich, we had Michael O'Neill on earlier on, and he spoke about Martin O'Neill and the job that he has done, and he thinks, look, we've all got to maybe just try and dismiss what we're all maybe talking about analysing performance, because he feels as though we're in a strong position in the group. Do you think that's the only thing that Martin O'Neill is thinking about? Do you think he's basically casting aside any sort of notion that, look, performances aren't great, okay, but we're getting the results and that is clearly all that matters, or is there a bigger picture here?
At the end of the day, because you know yourself and every fan in Ireland, all they want to do is get to the World Cup, and I don't know whether...
So that's it, that is it above everything else, and that is the only thing?
For me, if we go to the World Cup, like we went to the Euros and we beat Italy, everyone remembers that match against Italy and how where they were and how they felt when that happened. They don't remember many of the qualifiers that happened leading into it and the performances there. You know, it's just all about getting to major tournaments and getting to play in major games that people remember for a long time. And say if we go off to Russia next year and win a big important match, nobody's going to worry about a performance against Iceland or something like that a year previously. So I think for Martin, his remit will sort of be get to the World Cup. That's what I want to do, and along the way there's obviously going to be players who will make debuts, and the team will change over time naturally, so the team will always progress in that way. But whether we'll be left with a legacy in terms of this is how the Republic of Ireland play and this is our new style, I don't think that will happen.
Would you be concerned by what you saw last night in terms of it helping us to get towards the World Cup though?
Not really. It's hard to put the difference between international friendlies when the whole team has basically changed and qualifiers. And I think for Ireland, I think we've had this conversation before in terms of we just effective in what we do. You know, it's never been a pretty performance. We get the odd one where things go really well and we all play nice football. For us, it's just about results, and it's about putting that effort in and getting wins. I mean, sometimes it's not all about tactics, skill, or technique. It's just about hard work and luck sometimes, and unfortunately that's the way we have been for a long time.
Yeah. Good stuff, Richard.
Well done, Rich.
Thanks a million.
So, nice one, thank you.
John Egan has been talking about it. I just found out I was playing when we got to the stadium and the boss named the team. He just said, go out and play your own game. But I knew that anyway. It's a simple game and I tried to do my best.
See, I don't think that's good enough. I think you're doing him a disservice. I think you could give him some advice. I think you could say, do you know what? If they're stepping off you, bring it into midfield if you feel comfortable. Maybe look for a pass. Otherwise, go long this way. Let Kevin Doyle, let Hendrick know that.
Are the coaches not saying that? Steve Walford, Scopey, and Keane.
Well, exactly. He's just talking about Martin O'Neill, what Martin O'Neill would have said there. So Martin O'Neill would have been probably focusing on the team in general, and that's the sort of individual information that Steve Walford, Guppy, Roy Keane, whoever it would be.
Respectfully, Kev, he didn't play like someone who had that information given to him. Like, I think, like, Richard there was... like, you listen to what Richard Dunne just said, there was no leadership on the pitch and there wasn't any leadership on the sideline.
Yeah,
and he knows what he's talking about. I think we're giving him a bit of a free pass here. It was really bad. And a lot of the Welsh performance was really, really, really bad as well. Like, worrying. Like, I'm suddenly very worried about this team without Wes.
Yeah, well, we've already spoke about that.
But the point is, we'll always have the effort, as Richard says. There is a big difference with friendlies and proper qualifiers. But skill and work ethic is brilliant. Work ethic is great. But we should have more of a plan, it seems to me.
I do get your point totally on Wes Hoolahan, because how old's Wes now? 34, 35?
Yeah.
How many more? Maybe that is a worrying aspect, that when he hasn't played, when he's been out of the side, and even if he's not been in the squad and we've not got him to come off the bench, we have lacked any sort of spot. When he's come off the bench at times, whether it's been him or James McLean, they've given us something. Immediately we're at it, we're on the front foot, something a bit different. Whereas the other night against Wales, no, we lacked anything. Certainly heading into the final third, in the middle third, we lacked anything like that, because we didn't have a player that would perhaps take a couple of touches, kill the game, set the tempo of the game. We didn't have anyone that was prepared to do that. Nobody at all in midfield was prepared to do that. And that ultimately went against us. But the overriding factor is that we've got that point. Wales offered nothing, I thought. That was the thing. Apart from maybe Bale in those couple of moments, Wales didn't offer anything. So you can perhaps maybe look at that as an isolated game and go, yeah, okay, we have got away with it there. When we play against Austria, I do feel as though, yeah, we're going to have to do a bit more. We will. We're going to have to
do a bit more in that game. That's the acid test for this entire group.
Totally.
We were effectively missing our best four midfielders in the game against Wales, and we obsessed about what we would do with Gareth Bale, and it worked to a certain point, and then it stopped working. It stopped working when we were asked to be creative. Like, I can't get into the analysis of this Iceland game, because it's Conor Hearn and Jeff Hendrick playing a 4-4-2 with two wingers, one of whom is called Johnny Hayes. And we're like, I don't know if we're ever going to see Johnny Hayes playing for Ireland again.
Well, I think he did okay. I think John Hayes did well. I think he's certainly a player that could kick on and play more games. But
he's behind Boyle, he's behind McGeady, he's behind...
Hogan and McGeady. Yeah, probably
is. And McLean as well.
Yes, yeah, I'd probably say that as well. But it was a different option, I suppose, last night. The most alarming thing I think we've taken from these two games, over anything, defending brilliant. I thought John O'Shea was great. I thought as a defensive structure, great. But it's that real reluctance to take the ball in midfield. That's perhaps something that will need to be addressed leading into that Austria game. That it's not just saying, okay, if we get Wes Hoolahan back, he'll take it. That'll be his natural game anyway. But if he isn't fit and we're playing a bit deeper, we need someone that's going to take the ball and prepared to dictate it.
You'd expect Brady and Arthur to be doing it.
It depends where he's going to play Brady, whether or not he's going to play Brady at left back in the match. Well, the reason why he could do that, though, Jay, is because it frees up Arthur, it frees up McCarthy, it frees up Hoolahan to play. So he's got options then. Then you're playing a real attacking side.
Yeah.
That's the thing that he could take from that if he
Steve
plays
Moore's
Brady.
Been really good.
He's played well.
Just that last point, right, about the midfielders not taking it. Why are Myler and Whelan? Is it because Whelan can't do it? Is it because Myler can't do it?
I think, as I said to you before, I spoke to Joe, I spoke to you many times. Yes, they can do it. But I just think There's that nervousness that's around the side. And that was clearly there on Friday. Clearly there. And it was clearly there the other night as well. Perhaps that's maybe with Conor Horan making his debut as well. But Jeff Hendrick just hasn't quite been at it the last couple of games. He hasn't been at it. And I'm sure he probably, on reflection, looking back at his own performances, he'd suggest that himself.
Hendrick also said to you guys, though, that he'd got advice from Keane after that first game he played.
Yeah.
So there's some advice coming.
Yeah. I mean, it was... Don't get ahead of the ball, and it was 2 years old, that advice.
Sure, but it was the sense.
Brilliant, and that's what you want them to be doing. And you'd love, I think, you'd like Egan to have got a bit more. I think last night,
maybe got it at half time though. You know, like let's see you play.
They were certainly told to up the speed of it all. That's for sure, and that's something.
Well, it was clearly their second half. Clearly better. Yeah. It wasn't great, but better. Yeah.
All right, Jimmy by text says, lads, all this hand-wringing about a friendly, it's not the end of the world. Granted, I won't be watching the VHS again, but I'm sure the team will buck up its ideas for the next competitive match. We all hope you're right, Jimmy. In keeping with the chat about last night's friendly against Iceland, up next we're talking about the so-called friendly derby, Liverpool against Everton on Saturday. There have been 21 red cards in the last 49 Merseyside derbies.
News Talks Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
Thanks to Air, with UEFA Champions and Europa Leagues action. Brought to you by Air Sport.
Barmy has it on his Jeffers. But the whistle's gone. The whistle's gone. Oh, Jeffers. Well, those two might go for this. Oh, I think they're going to have to be sent off. And Vestergaard, if he goes... That would be criminal, really, to get involved like that, because it will mean Liverpool lose the goalkeeper. They might both go. You can't have a fight like that, even when passions are running high. Now, what's Mike Riley going to do here? Jeffers has been sent off, and so has Vestergaard. All hands to the pumps for Everton, and one of those hands, Kevin Campbell, has gone down, and Steven Gerrard is sent off. The third red card for Steven Gerrard's challenge. He goes as well. Well, what a night this is turning out to be at Anfield. Liverpool are down to 9 men.
And the injury could be bad for Beglin. Players from both sides calling the referee into action. They're calling for a stretcher immediately. Stevens had lost the ball, followed through and caught Beglin.
Neville onto it. Good ball back in too. Gerrard won it in the air. This is Kilbane for Everton. Looking for room where there's not. Gerrard flies in and might be in trouble here. Evertonians surrounding Phil Down, and Steven Gerrard, 17 minutes into the game, is going to be sent off. Steven Gerrard gets a second yellow card in the space of seconds, and Liverpool are down to 10 men. Challenge on Alonso. An angry response from Liverpool players. Van der Meijden seemed to lead with his elbow. Accidental or not, you cannot do that. Xabi Alonso felt the full force of the challenge, and Phil Dowd is going to have to make a decision here. And it's a red card for Van der Meijden. It's 10 against 10. It's yet another sending off in the Merseyside derby.
Oh yeah, we're going to get the details of that red card in that Merseyside derby from the man who was fouled by Steven Gerrard. But before we do all that, hello Richie.
Hey Ger.
Richie's here to talk to us about Steven Gerrard's autobiography called Gerrard, My Autobiography, from September 2007.
This great title.
Particularly important extract here to give us an insight into the mind of Stevie G.
Yeah, because he was fond of the odd missed timed tackle even. We were looking up a couple of these on YouTube outside, and there's a long litany of them. To be fair, there's one for England against Norway.
He's not that type of player, Richie.
He's not that type of player. That's clear to anybody who's ever seen Steven Gerrard play the game. But unfortunately, there's a lot of video evidence that would suggest he occasionally.
If Steven Gerrard had actually broken somebody's leg, like James Coleman, he was that type of player.
Gerrard is that type of player. Oh, like, he really was.
Joe, you can't say he's not that type of player.
He was actually filthy. Like Neil Taylor probably isn't that type of player. If we're going to allow this analogy or this cliche, but Gerrard was that. He was filthy.
How did he not kill somebody along the way?
There were several that came close.
Yeah. Go on, give us the good bit.
This from Gerrard's autobiography from 2007 called My Autobiography. It details a match against Galatasaray in a pre-season friendly.
I didn't know that.
Under Gerard Houllier in 2003. I hit Unsal with a tackle and the Dutch ref René Temmink booked me. Now the Turks were really after me. Another elbow. Bang. I was taking so many blows to the air I felt like a bloody boxer. Chaos reigned. Neil Mellor, our young striker, was goaded badly. He tackled Gabriel Tamás and nothing challenged, but Temmink sent him off. Shocker. Now I was really on the warpath, chasing around, hunting Turks, kicking anything that moved. Temmink gave a silly free kick against me for a foul on Unsal, and all the Turks immediately surrounded us. Their spit ran down my face. I wiped it off and tried to walk away. Suke punched me. It was the old Turkish game of provocation, and I fell for a classic stitch-up. Wound up by the Turks, I was maddened by Temmink's decision, convinced he'd been conned by them. You fat cheating! I told him. What? He said. Come here. Bang. Second yellow. Red. Off. Bollocks. The Turks were all smug, knowing the cheating had paid off and they were cruising to a 2-1 win. I couldn't believe Temmink could understand. He was foreign. I knew that because he was speaking foreign in the tunnel on the way out.
Boom.
Thank you.
A clever boy, Stevie G. Understands foreign.
They speak that in Spain apparently as well.
Hunting Turks.
Yeah, that shows a little bit of the mentality.
It also shows like 2007, you can get away with stuff. Yeah.
Who's the ghostwriter who allowed him the sentence?
Wasn't
he was
Henry
speaking
Winter
foreign.
Was the ghostwriter in one of them?
Who?
Henry Winter was the ghostwriter in at least one of his autobiographies.
So Henry allowed he was speaking foreign to go forward?
Quite possible.
he's had to get into his mind.
Had to capture
Joe.
His voice.
Yeah. With a big smile on his face going, I'm going to get that quote framed in my jacks.
Oh.
So tell us about playing against Stevie G. In that bit that we've just heard, he gets booked for kicking the ball away, and then he nearly kills you but gets a second yellow for it.
Yeah, I think he got two yellow cards quite quickly. The second one, one famous radio commentator said I actually dived over in the UK. Yeah,
who?
Alan Green.
Yeah, was it?
Yeah,
was it?
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
he said you dived.
He said I dived. Yeah, it was.
Well, like you know,
it was an outrageous.
It was
tackle.
Steven Gerrard and it's Alan Green.
But he's a Man United fan.
Yeah, but it's Steven Gerrard.
Wow. Oh, is he a Liverpool fan? I was assuming he was a Man United fan. All right. Oh, well, that changes everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He launched.
Why did you mouth that?
He launched into that one. He launched into that one. Did I mouth it? I didn't.
Yeah.
No, he launched into it, yeah.
Yeah. I notice in the replay, he launches into you and then makes, like, you get up and you look. So you do him a favour by getting up, which was your first mistake. But then you get up and walk right towards him and he just completely ignores you and is off towards the referee, which was doubly disrespectful.
You said something to him on the way past.
I think something along the lines that was a bad one. Something that. And anyway, yeah, he went. It's quite funny. But Richie just talked about there. We looked at some of the montage out there from some of Gerrard's tackles. Some of them were just outrageous.
The Kevin Campbell one.
Outrageous.
I remember.
Honest
I remember.
To God. Look, George Boateng. Look at the George Boateng one.
Oh, he killed
it,
George Boateng,
is
yeah.
Unbelievable, yeah. The one on Boateng. Now, that was, we're talking, we know what Bale's tackle was last week. In detail. This was horrendous.
Worst, yeah.
I was at that game, actually.
Honest to God. And there was, that was a regular thing, particularly in his early days with Gerrard. There's one he did on Gary Naismith as well, a two-footer on Gary Naismith.
He loved diving two-footer.
Yeah, no booking for that one.
Yeah.
Just literally on you go. On you go, son. Thanks for it. Smack on the arse. On you go. And that was it. But that was, I don't know, I played another Merseyside derby. I think Phil Neville was sent off and somebody else. We got quite a lot sent off in those games. Yeah.
Neville cites that as one of the moments that Everton fans said, he's all right now.
Did he
kind of feel like he's ours and not just Manchester United, former Manchester United player Phil Neville. He would say that himself.
Is it?
He noticed a real warming in the relationship between him and the Everton fans when he got sent off.
So
you've got to
get a red derby. You've got to get a red Merseyside
derby.
It's
a short, either score or get sent off is a shortcut, yeah.
Yeah, well,
did you enjoy those games?
Yeah, they were great. They were great. It's something that we never had great success. 99, I wasn't even at the club when the last Merseyside derby was won at Anfield, where it is this weekend. Played in a win around Christmas time. Lee Carsey scored against Chris Kirkland at the Gladys Street end, and we had our Christmas party afterwards, so that was quite nice.
Wow.
That was quite nice, yeah. Why we arranged a Christmas party after the Merseyside derby, I don't know.
It's risky.
Yeah, very risky. But the risk paid off. Risk and reward.
Would the players ever socialise in your day, in your time at the club, see each other about, be on friendly enough terms?
We were close to Stevie Finnan, yeah. Stevie Finnan played against him regularly. Chris Kirkland as well would have been another. I knew him, so.
And would you hang out in the city for a coffee, or was that a no-no?
Yeah, would have done.
Oh, would you?
Yeah, would have done, yeah.
And would anyone come up to you and go, what's going on here?
No, never really.
That's good.
Keep your head down, stay out of the way, really. Yeah, but I'd regularly go out and meet Finney and I'd meet Chris Kirkland, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How you
endless
doing?
Curiosity, isn't he? You just want to know what what goes on in football teams behind the scenes. I have a million questions as
this
well.
This is Liverpool and Everton players meeting each other.
Yeah, I know. I can't get over it. Yeah. I would have thought it's like the Blues and the Crips or something in LA. I would have thought you get close to each other, you just start shooting each other. You know?
Yeah, no, none of that. None
That's what we kind of hope goes on, you know.
Yeah, it was amicable.
My God.
Yeah. Do you want to hear some of it? Was Henry Winter who wrote that actually?
He spoke foreign.
2006, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear
foreign. He was speaking foreign. Yeah.
I thought George Burn was the only person who used that phrase.
Yeah.
Stephen Gerrard, too. This is Ronaldinho's debut single.
Great.
Sozinho. Sozinho. Sozinho.
Sozinho.
Sozinho means alone.
Sozinho. Sozinho.
I'm just tired of it.
Eu agora sozinho não me sinto mais fraco ou mais forte, mas quem sabe a sorte.
Initial thoughts?
It's not as bad as I was expecting.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It wins you over straight away. Yeah. This is not
I got concerned when your head started to read it.
No, I enjoy it, yeah.
Yeah, I could see you were getting into because you have fun.
It doesn't sound great at the start, does it? It doesn't sound like it's not a great intro. Then all of a sudden,
why is he doing this? Do we know?
He's mega rich.
New career?
Yeah. His new career, yeah.
It's a lifelong dream.
Yeah, because most footballers, in all due respect, when they reach the FA Cup final or something and they're rolled into the studio to do the single, it's never good.
Yeah.
It's never good. Yeah. They always seem like two worlds that don't go well together.
Yeah, possibly. That could be true.
Waddle and Hoddle.
Yeah, exactly. There have been so many of them.
Well, that was good, though, Tom.
I don't know about that. Yeah, don't
they
know
were called Chris and Glenn, unfortunately, though. That was the thing. If they didn't call Waddle and Hoddle, it might have had some kind of novelty life.
Yeah. Yes. I made this thing about I do the best film soundtracks and it's turned into my life's work. I've spent nearly 2 days.
The harder they come.
There were so many of them.
Pulp Fiction.
The harder they come.
Pulp Fiction is just... It's so far ahead of everything else. Yeah. To be honest, Tarantino is so far ahead.
It's the harder they come.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, Jimmy Cliff made a film about a rap artist getting rich and then being shot by the police. And it's amazing.
It's not even on my list.
Oh, well, you have to.
And I spent all day. I've gone through 3 million.
I do like 8 Mile as well.
How long is your list?
Hundreds.
Is Lost in Translation make it there?
Yeah, I've broken into genres. I've gone for crap film, great soundtrack. That's an entire genre.
You know, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels as well.
Very good.
Classic.
Yeah,
classic soundtrack.
Good.
Judgment Night.
Yeah, coolest ones. Ones that are just really, really cool. indie ones. There's millions of them as well.
Yeah.
Blockbusters. 3,000 of them. And then there's director. It just goes where the director has really cool taste, and obviously it's going to be Tarantino's entire section.
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs goes well in it. Yeah,
he's just got an in with music. He's got a way of connecting music with scenes that is just off the clock. It really is.
I would think you're a Cameron Crowe man as well, are you?
Cameron Crowe is great. There's loads of them. Oliver Stone is great. Scorsese is great. A guy called John Bryan, you might know of him, but it's like Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love and.
Magnolia's brilliant.
Yeah, it's real composition stuff. It's really great placement of music, you know.
Yeah, a bit of Amy Mann.
Greatest intro to a film is Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Ocean Colour Scene, 100 Mile High City. It's the best start of a film that's out there. It's just incredible, yeah.
JP, tell
every
me
week.
That.
you can't imagine Raging Bull.
Kevin, you should have your answer.
You can't imagine Raging Bull without the music.
Yeah, exactly.
Just can't.
Yeah.
You were going to bring in a deadly picture of you at a charity match at YouTube. Yeah, right. Where's the picture?
I got too nervous. It's too stupid. Just
come on.
Oh, we're putting that on the Off the Ball Twitter feed, yeah.
Yeah, I think I need a few drinks before I produce it.
Well, we'll sort that out for next Thursday night.
I will bring it in, but I got cold feet over it, you know. There's a photograph of me on the Irish team, but then I prefer the Welsh team. It's 3 members of Def Leppard are lining up for them and they're in full makeup is all I could say.
We're going to take a quick break, right back after these.
News Talks Off the Ball,
home of the Saturday panel.
Thanks to AIR. Catch Leinster versus Wasps exclusively live this weekend on the AIR Sport Pack.
All right, you're very welcome back. 53106, the text number here. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet the show at Off the Ball as well. Video technology was used in an international friendly last night to good effect.
Yep.
Two goals, one given, one not.
Yeah, France v Spain last night. First goal, I think it was Antoine Griezmann. He had a goal which the referee had given. Immediately then went to the video referee. 40 seconds was the time that it took to make the decision. Referee disallowed the goal, even after the celebration had gone ahead and the crowd went mad. And then a second time, then it was Gerard Deulofeu who scored a goal. The goal was disallowed. Upon review, again, 40 seconds. So it's not really that much of... When we saw the one at the World Club Championship that was about 2.5 minutes, which was such a delay. The referee actually left the pitch and went over to view it. So it wasn't that time-consuming. It worked. It was easy. I think the only thing about it is we couldn't actually watch the analysis of the decision, but the referee made the decision, the video referee made the decision for the referee, and both decisions were correct. So... You know, it's something that we'll wait and see whether it's going to come into the Premier League. Richard Scudamore and the Premier League have said that they're quite content to take the back seat on this. Let others trial it, let others use it.
Yeah.
But FIFA are saying they want it in place for the World Cup in Russia next year. So it'd be interesting to see how it's going to go about and how it's going to develop. Yeah,
happy days.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Particularly for the big moments, and I think that's what when we had Alan Kelly on early on this year, when he spoke about these decisions, he said, "Look, we don't want it to be you're going to go back in a move and you're going to have a constant. The referee's constantly going to be questioned. We don't want that, but we want the key moments when we can clearly see them within 10, 15, 20 seconds, whatever it is. And that's what it looks to me like. It's a sensible option, definitely.
Well, one of the last remaining arguments against bringing in video technology seems to be, but what would we talk about?
Yeah.
Well, the game.
Yeah.
There's nothing more tiresome than referee decisions.
Yeah, and like the whole notion as well about it has to be at every game, it doesn't. Like, we understand that the World Cup final means more than a kickabout in Phoenix Park.
And I don't think, I'm led to believe, I don't think it's going to be like decisions like penalty decisions. They're not going to influence that, I don't believe.
All right.
I don't think so. From what, I'm sure that's what Alan Kelly was saying. It's going to be around goal.
Okay.
Around goals, essentially. So the referees will still be questioned on what they do around penalties and things, yeah.
All right. That's all we have time for. But earlier on, we asked you to name the famous lane that leads up to the clubhouse at Augusta. The answer is Magnolia Lane. Congratulations to Tom Moran, Bobby McDermott, Des Farrell and Glenn Tunney. You all win yourself two places in our Off the Ball Golf Day, which tees off at 1 o'clock next Wednesday. There's going to be food, golf, and we're going to be broadcasting the whole show live from the clubhouse, where we will be joined by some very special guests for a preview of the Masters. You'll also have a chance to win a one-year membership at Luttrellstown Castle, along with a lesson from former European Tour winner Peter Laurie. It's all thanks to Luttrellstown Castle Golf Club, offering a premium golfing experience in majestic countryside setting, just 20 minutes from Dublin City Centre. Tom Dunn's up next. Good night.